It was easy to imagine the same could be true of Mary Wagner, but a reliable diagnosis would take more time than we were likely to have together. That particular question was sidelined a few hours into my research. I clicked onto a new page and sadly found exactly what I was looking for. A triple homicide in Derby Line, Vermont, on August 2, 1983. All three victims were siblings. Bulak, Brendan, age 8. Bulak, Ashley, age 5. Constantine, Adam, age 11 months. The killer, their mother, was a 26-year-old woman with the last name Constantine. First name, Mary. I cross-referenced the homicide report for local media coverage. It brought me to an article from a 1983 Caledonian Record in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. There was also a grainy black-and-white trial photo of Mary Constantine seated at a defendant's table. Her face was thinner and younger, but the detached, stony expression was unmistakable. That look she had when she didn't want to feel something, or had felt too much. Jesus. The woman I knew as Mary Wagner had killed her own children more than 20 years ago, and as far as she was concerned, it had never happened. I pushed back my chair and took a deep breath. Here I was, finally at the center of the labyrinth. Now it was time to start finding my way back out. Chapter 107. 1983, huh? Jeez, that's not even this century. All right, hang on a second. I'll try to help you out if I can. I sat through several minutes of tapping keys and rifling paper on the other end of the phone line. The tapper and rifler was an agent named Barry Medler of the Bureau's Albany field office. He was the coordinator of Albany's Crimes Against Children Unit. Every FBI office has a CAC unit, and Albany has oversight for Vermont. I wanted to get as close to the source as I possibly could. Here we go, Medler said. Hold on. Here she is. Constantine, Mary. Triple homicide on August 2nd, arrested on the 10th. Now let me scroll the rest of this. Okay, here we go. Sentenced NGRI on February 1st of the following year with a state-appointed attorney. Not guilty by reason of insanity, I muttered. So she hadn't been able to afford her own defense. No legal bells and whistles on her behalf. Not guilty by reason of insanity can be a tough plea to prove. It must have been a fairly clear-cut case for it to go that way. Where did she end up? I asked. Vermont State Hospital in Waterbury, probably. I wouldn't have any transfer records here, but that ward isn't exactly overflowing. I can get you a name and a number if you want to find out. It was tempting to pull a little, no, I want you to find out attitude, but I preferred to make the calls myself anyway. I took down the number for Vermont State Hospital. What about Mary Constantine's M.O.? I asked Medler. What have you got on the actual murders? I heard more turning pages, and then, unbelievable. What is it? Didn't your Mary Smith use a Walther PPK out there in L.A.? Yeah, why? Ditto here. Walther PPK, never recovered either. She must have dog-boned it. I was scribbling notes furiously the whole time he talked. To say the least, he had me riveted. All right, Agent Medler, here's what I need. Get me a contact for whatever Mary Constantine's local police department would have been. I also want everything you've got on file there. Send whatever's electronically available right now and fax the rest. And I mean everything. I'm going to give you my cell number in case you find anything else worth mentioning. I'll be on the move. I stuffed some papers into my briefcase while I was still talking to Medler. One other thing. What airlines fly to Vermont, anyway? Chapter 108. 18 hours and 3,000 miles later, I was sitting in the small, cozy living room of Madeline and former Sheriff Claude LaPierre, just outside Derby Line, Vermont. It was a tiny village, as sweet as a calendar photo, and literally pressed up against the Canadian border. In fact, the local Haskell Free Library and Opera House had been accidentally built on the border, and guards were sometimes stationed inside to prevent illegal crossings. Not the kind of place you'd imagine would keep law enforcement very busy, though. Mary Constantine had lived there all her life, right up until she killed her three young children, a horrifying crime that had made national headlines 20 years ago. "What would you say you remember most about the case?" I asked Mr. LaPierre.
"The knife. For sure, the knife. The way she cut up that poor little girl's face after she killed all three of them. I was Orleans County Sheriff for 27 years. It was the worst thing I ever saw. By far, Agent Cross. By far."
I actually felt kind of sorry for her.
Mrs. LaPierre sat next to her husband on the couch, which was covered in a denim blue fabric.
"For Mary, I mean. Nothing good ever happened to that poor woman. Not that it excuses what she did, but..."
She waved her hand in front of her face instead of finishing the thought.
"You knew her, Mrs. LaPierre?"
"The way everybody knows everybody around here," she said. "This is a community of neighbors. We all depend on one another."
"What can you tell me about Mary before all this happened?" I asked both of them. Claude LaPierre started.
"Nice girl. Quiet, polite, loved boating. On Lake Memphremagog. Not a whole lot to tell, really. She worked at the diner when she was in high school. Served me breakfast all the time. But so very quiet, like I said. Everyone was pretty surprised when she got pregnant.
And even more surprised when the father stuck around," Mrs. LaPierre said.
"For a while, anyway," her husband quickly added.
"I assume that was Mr. Bulak?" They both nodded.
"He was 10 years older than her, and she was all a 17. But they did make a go of it. Tried their best. Even had a second kid together."
"Ashley,"
Mrs. LaPierre said.
"Nobody was really bowled over when he finally took off. If anything, I would have expected it sooner."
"George Bulak was a real bum," said Mrs. LaPierre. "Took a lot of drugs."
"Do you know what happened to him? Did he see Mary or the kids again?"
"Don't know," said Claude, "but I'm inclined to doubt it. He was a bum."
"Well, I need to find him," I muttered, more to myself than to either of them. "I really need to know where George Bulak is now."
"Up to no good, for sure," said Mrs. LaPierre.
Chapter 109. I didn't bother taking notes after that. Whatever wasn't already written down, I wouldn't need. A whirring sound had been coming from the kitchen, and I finally asked Mrs. LaPierre about it. I never would have guessed what the sound was. Turned out she was making deer jerky in a dehydrator. "Where were Mary's parents during all of this?" I asked, moving back to more pertinent questions. Again, Mrs. LaPierre shook her head. She topped off my coffee cup while her husband continued.
"Rita died when Mary was about 5, I guess. Ted raised her pretty much on his own, though he didn't seem to put a lot of effort into it. Nothing illegal, just real sad. And then he died, too. The year Brendan was born, I think."
"He smoked like a chimney," Madeline said. "Lung cancer took him. That poor girl never got a break."
After George Bulak left, Mary fell in love with another local man, a part-time mechanic by the name of John Constantine.
"He started running around on her almost as soon as she got pregnant," Madeline said. "It was no great secret. By the time Adam was 6 months old, John was gone for good, too."
Claude spoke now.
"If I had to guess,
I'd say that's when she really went downhill. But who knows? You don't see someone for a while, you just assume they're busy or something. And then one day, boom. That was it. She must have snapped. It felt sudden, but it probably wasn't. I'm sure it was building up over a long period. I sipped my coffee and took a polite bite of scone. I'd like to go back to the day of the murders now. What did Mary have to say when she was caught, Sheriff? This is more piecework than anything. Just my memories. We never got a peep out of Mary about the murders after her arrest. Anything you can tell me would be helpful. Try to think, Sheriff. Madeline took a deep breath and put a hand flat on top of her husband's on the couch cushion. They both had the solid quality of old farm stock, not unlike what I'd seen in Mary at times. It looks like she took them for a picnic that day. Drove way out in the woods. We found the spot later, just by luck. That's where she shot them. 1, 2, 3, in the back of the head. The Emmy thinks she laid them down, like maybe for a nap, and I'm guessing she did the older two first, since the baby couldn't run away. I waited patiently for him to go on. I knew that the passage of time didn't make this kind of thing any easier to remember and talk about. She carefully wrapped them each in a blanket. I still remember those old army blankets she used. Terrible. Then it looks like she took them home and did the knife work on Ashley there. All over her face, and just on her for some reason. I'll never forget it. I'd like to, but I can't.
And were you the first one to find them? I asked. He nodded.
Mary's boss called and said he hadn't seen Mary for days. Mary didn't have a phone at the time, so I said I'd go over. I thought it was just a courtesy call. Mary came to the door like there was nothing going on, but I could smell it right away. Literally. She'd put them all in a trunk in the basement, in August, and just left them there. I guess she blocked that smell out like everything else. I still can't explain any of it, not even now, after all these years.
Sometimes there is no explanation, I said.
Anyway, she didn't put up any resistance whatsoever. We took her in quietly.
It was a huge story, though, Madeline said.
That's true. Put Derby Line on the map for about a week. Hope it doesn't happen again now.
Did either of you see Mary after she was committed? Both LaPierres shook their head. Decades of marriage had clearly linked them.
I don't know anyone who ever visited her, Madeline told me. It's not the kind of thing you want to be reminded about, is it? People like to feel safe around here. It wasn't that anyone turned their back on her. It was more like, I don't know, like we never knew Mary in the first place.
Chapter 110. Vermont State Hospital was a sprawling, mostly red brick building, unassuming from the outside except for its size. I had been told that almost half of it was unused space. The women's locked ward on the fourth floor held forensic patients, like Mary Constantine, but also civilly committed patients.
Not a perfect system, the director told me, but one born of small population size and shrinking budgets for mental health care.
It was also part of the reason Mary had been able to escape. Dr. Rodney Blaisdale, the director, gave me a quick tour of the ward. It was well kept, with curtains in the day room and a fresh coat of paint on the concrete block walls. Newspapers and magazines were spread on most end tables and couches. Burlington Free Press, The Chronicle, American Woodworker. It was quiet. So quiet. I'd been on locked wards many times before, and usually the general noise level was like a constant buzz. I had no idea until now how oddly comforting that buzz could be.
It occurred to me that Vermont State had the still, slow-moving quality of an aquarium. Patients seemed to come and go in response to the quiet itself, barely speaking, even to themselves. The television was on a low volume, with a few women watching the soaps through what looked like Haldol glazed eyes. As Dr. Blaisdell took me around, I kept thinking about how vivid a scream would be in here. "This is it," he said as we came to one of many closed doors in the main hallway. I realized I had stopped listening to him and tuned back in. This was Mary's room. Looking through the small observation window in that steel door, I found no clue that she had ever been there, of course. The platform bed held a bare mattress, and the only other features were a built-in desk and bench and a stainless steel blunt-edged shelf mounted to the wall. Of course, it didn't look like this then. Mary was with us for 19 years, and she could do a lot with very little. Our own Martha Stewart, he chuckled.
She was my friend.
I turned to see a tiny middle-aged woman standing with one shoulder pressed against the wall opposite us. Her standard-issue scrubs indicated she was forensic, though it was hard to imagine what she might have done to get here. Hello, I said. The woman raised her chin, trying to see past us into Mary's room. Now I saw that she had ragged burn scars up and down her neck.
Is she back? Is Mary here? I need to see Mary if she's here. It's important. It's very important to me.
No, Lucy. I'm sorry. She's not back, Dr. Blaisdell told her. Lucy looked crestfallen. She quickly turned and walked away from us, disconsolately trailing one hand along the concrete block wall as she went. Lucy's one of our few really long-term patients here, as was Mary. It was hard for her when Mary disappeared. About that, I said. What happened that day? Dr. Blaisdell nodded slowly and bit into his lower lip. Why don't we finish this in my office? Chapter 111. I followed Blaisdell through the locked door at the end of the ward and down to the ground floor. We entered his office, which was high-end generic, with brass inboxes and pastel-colored mini-blinds. A poster for Banjo Dan and the Midnight Plowboys was framed on one wall and definitely caught my attention. I sat down and noticed that everything on my side of his desk was several inches from the edge, just out of reach. Blaisdell looked at me and sighed. I knew right away that he was going to soft sell what had happened with Mary Constantine. All right, here goes, Dr. Cross. Everyone on the ward can earn day trip privileges. Forensic patients used to be prohibited, but we've found it therapeutically unconstructive to divide the population in that way. As a consequence, Mary went out several times. That day was just like any other.
And what happened on that day? I asked.
It was 6 patients with 2 staff, which is our standard procedure. The group went to the lake that day. Unfortunately, one of the patients had a meltdown of some sort.
Of some sort? I wondered if he knew the exact details even now. Blaisdell seemed like a hands-off administrator if I'd ever seen one.
In the middle of the hysterics, Mary insisted she had to go to the restroom. The outhouse building was right there, so the counselors let her go. Mistake, but it happens. No one knew at the time that there were entrances on both sides of the building.
Obviously Mary knew, I said.
Dr. Blaisdell drummed a pen on his desktop several times. At any rate, she disappeared into nearby woods.
I stared at him, just listening, trying not to judge, but it was hard not to.
She was a model patient, had been for years. It took everyone very much by surprise.
Just like when she killed her kids, I said. Blaisdell appraised me with his eyes,
He wasn't sure if I had just insulted him, and I certainly hadn't meant to.
The police did a major search, one of the biggest I've seen. We left that job to them. Of course, we were eager to have Mary back and to make sure she was all right, but it's not the kind of story we go out of our way to publicize. She wasn't...
He stopped. Wasn't what?
Well, at the time, we didn't consider her any danger to anyone, other than herself, perhaps.
I didn't say what I was thinking. All of Los Angeles had a somewhat different opinion of Mary, that she was the most vicious homicidal maniac who ever lived. Did she leave anything behind? I finally asked.
She did, actually. You'll definitely want to see her journals. She wrote almost every day, filled dozens of journals while she was here.
Chapter 112. A porter, Mac, who looked as though he lived in the basement of the hospital, brought me two archive boxes filled with tape-bound composition notebooks, the kind a child raised in the 50s might have used in school. Mary Constantine had written far more in her years here than I would ever have time to read today. I could requisition the whole collection later, I was informed. Thanks for your help, I told Mac the porter.
No problem, he said, and I wondered when it was and how the response, "You're welcome," seemed to have disappeared from the language, even up here in rural Vermont. For now, I just wanted to get a sense of who Mary Constantine was, particularly in relationship to the Mary I already knew. Two archive boxes would be enough for a start. Her cursive was tidy and precise. Every page was neatly arranged, with even, empty margins. Not a doodle in sight. Words were her medium, and she had no shortage of them. They slanted to the right on the page as if they were in a hurry to get where they were going. The voice, too, was eerily familiar. The writing had Mary Smith's short, choppy sentences and that same palpable sense of isolation. It was evident everywhere I looked in the notebook. Sometimes it just seeped through. Other times it was right on the surface.
I'm like a ghost here. I don't know if anyone would care whether I stayed or left, or if they even know I'm here at all. Except for Lucy. Lucy is so kind to me. I don't know that I could ever be as good a friend to her as she is to me. I hope she doesn't go anywhere. It wouldn't be the same without her. Sometimes I think she's the only one who really cares about me, or knows me, or can see me. Am I invisible to everyone else? I truly wonder. Am I invisible?
Reading through and picking out entries at random, I also got a picture of someone who stayed busy while she was kept in the mental hospital. There was always one project or another going on for Mary. She'd never given up hope, had she? She seemed to be the resident homemaker, as much as a person could be in this environment.
We're making paper chains for the day room. A little babyish, but they're pretty. It will be nice for Christmas. I showed all the girls how to make them. Almost everyone participated. I love to teach them things. Most of them, anyway. That Roseanne girl from Burlington, she tries my patience sometimes. She truly does. She looked right at me today and asked me what my name is. As if I haven't already told her 1,000 times. I don't know what kind of somebody she thinks she is. She's just as much a nobody as the rest of us. I didn't know what to say to her, so I just didn't answer. Let her make her own decorations. Serves her right. I'd like to smack Roseanne. But I won't, will I?
Somebody's and nobody's. Those words and that idea had shown up more than once in the emails out in California. The inclusion of it here jumped out at me like an identification tag. Mary Smith had been obsessed with somebodies. high-profile, perfect mothers who stood out so clearly against the negative space of her own nobodiness. Something told me that if I kept looking, I'd find it as a long-running theme for Mary Constantine as well. What was missing was any mention of her children. In context, the journals read like a chronicle of denial. The Mary who lived here at the hospital seemed to have recorded no memory or awareness of them at all. And the woman who lived as Mary Wagner, the woman Mary Constantine had become, could think of nothing but those children. The common thread as she had evolved was a lack of consciousness around Brendan, Ashley's, and Adam's murder. The A's and B's. I could only hypothesize at this point, but it seemed to me that Mary was on a crash course toward a fuller realization and wreaking havoc along the way. Now that she was in custody again, the only person she could harm was herself. Still, if she was in fact moving toward the truth, I hated to think what might happen to her when she got there. Chapter 113. It was hard to tear myself away from Mary's journals, her words, her ideas, and her anger. For the first time, it seemed possible to me, even probable, that she had actually committed the series of murders in L.A. When I looked at my watch, I was already half an hour late for a meeting with her lead therapist, Deborah Shapiro. Shit, I need to hustle over there. Dr. Shapiro was actually on her way out when I got to her office. I was full of apology. Shapiro stayed to speak with me, but was perched on the edge of a couch with her briefcase on her lap. "Mary was my patient for 8 years," she told me before I even asked. "How would you characterize her?" "Not as a killer, interestingly. I view the incident with her children as an aberration to the larger arena, if you will, of her mental illness. She's a very sick woman, but any violent impulses were subjugated a long time ago. That's part of what kept her here. She never moved through anything." "How can you be sure?" I asked Dr. Shapiro. "Especially given what's happened. Maybe Mary wasn't the only person in denial around here." "If I were testifying in court, I'd have to say I can't. Beyond that, though, I think 8 years of interaction is worth something, Dr. Cross. Don't you?" I did think so, of course, but only if the therapist showed me some insight. "What about her children?" I asked. "I didn't find any mention of them in her journals, but for the short time I've known Mary, they've been all she can think about. They're very much alive in her mind now. She's obsessed with them." Dr. Shapiro nodded while she looked at her watch. "That's more difficult for me to reconcile. I could offer a theory, which is that maybe Mary's therapy was finally actualizing. The memory of those children was slowly, slowly bubbling up. As the children came into her consciousness, one way to avoid processing 20 years of repressed guilt all at once would be to keep the children alive, as you put it. It could explain what drove her to escape when she did, to get back to her life with them. Which, to Mary's experience, is exactly what happened." "And these murders in California?" I was going very quickly on purpose. Dr. Shapiro fidgeted as though she might jump up and leave at any moment. She shrugged, clearly impatient with the interview. I wondered if her therapy sessions felt like this to her patients. "I just don't see it. It's hard to know what might have happened to Mary once she left here, but as for the woman that I knew..." She shook her head back and forth several times. "The only part of the story that makes sense is Los Angeles." "How so?" I asked. "There was some interest in her story a few years ago. Some movie people came and went. Mary permitted the interviews, but as a state's ward, she didn't have the autonomy to grant any farther-reaching permission. Eventually, they lost interest and went away. During her last couple of years here, I think they were the only visitors she had." "Who?" I took out my notebook, folded it open. "I need to know more about this. Are there records of the visits? Anything?" "I don't actually recall any names," she said. And beyond that, I'm a bit uncomfortable with the level of disclosure here. I might refer you back to Dr. Blaisdell if you want more specific information. He'd be the one to release it. I wondered if she was feeling protective of her patient, or maybe just late for something on her social calendar. The clock said 5:46. I realized I might do better elsewhere, in which case I had to get going as well. I thanked Dr. Shapiro for her time and help and headed back to the administration building. I was running. Chapter 114. Still in all, I was feeling like a real cop again, and it didn't seem half bad to me. The wall clock in the administrative office said 5:52 when I slipped in. I smiled across the counter at a young woman with pink-streaked blonde hair and a lot of costume jewelry. She was draping a plastic cover over her typewriter. "Hi, I've got a really quick request for you. Really quick. I need it, though." "Can't it wait until tomorrow?" the woman asked, eyeing me up and down. "It can wait, right?" "Actually, no. I just spoke with Dr. Shapiro, and she asked me to run down here and catch you. I need to see the Women's Forensic Ward visitor's log for the last few years, specifically for Mary Constantine. It's really important. I wouldn't bother you otherwise." The woman picked up her phone.
"Dr. Shapiro sent you?"
"That's right. She just left for the day, but she told me this wouldn't be a problem." I held up my ID. "I'm with the FBI, Dr. Alex Cross. This is part of an ongoing murder investigation." She didn't hide her displeasure.
"I just shut down the computer and I have to pick up my daughter. I suppose I can get you the hard copy if you want."
Without waiting for an answer, she disappeared into another room and came back with a small stack of three-ring binders.
"You can only stay as long as Beadsy's here."
She waved to a woman in a goldfish bowl office at the back. Then she left without another word, to me or to Beadsy. The pages of the visitor's log were divided into columns. I worked from the back of the most recent book, looking for Mary's name under "Who Are You Here to See?" For 2 years' worth of entries, there was nothing at all. It was obvious how alone Mary Constantine had been in this place. Then, suddenly, a rash of names cropped up on the log. Here was the flurry of interest that Dr. Shapiro mentioned. It lasted over the course of about a month and a half. I slowed down and perused the visitors' names. Most were unfamiliar to me. One of them, I recognized. Chapter 115. My cell phone and Vermont seemed to hate each other. Apparently, this was the land of no signal. I found a payphone instead, called Agent Page in Los Angeles, and had him patch in LAPD. A minute later, we had Maddox Fielding's office on the line, but no Fielding. What a surprise. "You know what?" I said to the nameless lieutenant on the line. "Screw it. Transfer us over to Detective Gene Galletta."
"What's going on?"
Page asked me again, while we were on hold with LAPD. Then I heard another voice on the line. "Gene Galletta? Is this Alex?" "Gene, it's Alex, all right. Carl Page from the LA Bureau office is on the line, too. I'm in Vermont. I think I have important news on the Mary Smith case." "I think I may have another connection for you. A murder in Vancouver," Gene said. "What are you doing all the way up in Vermont?" "Hold that thought about Vancouver. Please find Fielding, or do whatever you have to, but someone needs to pick up Michael Bell for questioning. Michael Bell, Marty Lowenstein Bell's husband."
"What?"
Gene sounded incredulous. Then Page swore, obviously muffling the receiver. I gave them a very quick rundown of my last 2 days up here, then finally the names on the visitor log at the state hospital. "He knows Mary Constantine. He's visited her here in Vermont before. Several times, actually."
"And what? He's been setting her up?" How would he even know she was in L.A.?
I don't know everything yet. Maybe she looked him up when she got there. Maybe they corresponded. If he wanted her story, it would have been worth something. I think he did want it, just not for a movie.
You think it was a cover? Maybe to kill his own wife?
That's a big-ass cover-up, Alex.
Sure is. It's an incredible story, too.
Paige, are you getting this?
Got it.
And I like it. Finally, something makes some sense to me.
Good. Then do a direct cross-reference. Michael Bell and anyone else connected to this case.
I wonder if he had a bigger agenda than just his wife.
Find out anything you can, Surfer Boy. All we need now is enough to justify holding him once LAPD gets him into custody.
Gene, listen, please. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
I say figure it out later and get a cruiser over to Michael Bell's house, now.
And Gene?
What?
Don't go over there by yourself. I'm pretty sure that Bell is our killer.
Chapter 116. Suddenly, the whole case was on fire again. About 10 miles from the hospital, I pulled over at the first gas station I saw, an ancient Texaco with a flying A over the roof. A Ford F-150 pulled in after me, but the only other building in sight was a darkened sugar house in a field directly across the road. I could see a couple of Holsteins grazing in the field. I called Carl Page again from another payphone. I needed to hear what he'd found out about Michael Bell. At this late hour, catching a flight out of Burlington seemed unlikely. I wanted to stay updated all the same, and was concerned for Page and Gene Galletta. Who knew what Bell was up to in L.A.?
What have you got so far? I asked him.
Amazing what you find when you look in the right place, he said. Before she died, Marty Lowenstein Bell had just sold her own show to HBO. She was hotter than a $50 pistol. On the other hand, Michael Bell's last three solo projects went nowhere. His only big successes had been with her, and it looked like she was checking out. She was divorcing him, Alex. They hadn't yet filed, but a friend of hers knew it was coming.
What did you say to me once?
Cha-ching?
Yeah, and the hits keep coming.
LAPD checked Bell's alibis all right, but they all revolved around his being seen at work, or occasionally at home.
Alex, the alibis aren't going to hold up.
And listen to this. Arnold Griner seriously trashed more than one of Bell's movies when he wrote for Variety. Griner actually called him Michael Bomb in one column, that kind of thing. Of course, in Griner's case, it might be justifiable homicide. Antonia Schiffman? She backed out of a project that Bell was financing himself last year. Apparently after she gave him a verbal promise, which seems to mean next to nothing out here. The whole thing fell apart, and he lost $500,000 in development. I could hear the adrenaline in Page's voice. He was like a greyhound at the gate.
I'll bet anything there's more, he said.
Bell's career was headed down the crapper, and he was going to bring everyone down with him.
Keep digging, I said. Great work, too. Any more word from LAPD? Gene?
A cruiser went by the Bell house. No answer.
Did they go inside?
No, but they were pretty sure nobody was home. The house is under surveillance.
All right, I'll call when I stop again. Probably out near the airport. Unfortunately, I think I'm stuck here for the night.
I didn't want to spend the night in Vermont, especially now, but it didn't look as though I had much of a choice. I thought about stopping into the small store at the gas station, buying something awful like chocolate cupcakes or M&Ms with peanuts, but I mustered all of my willpower against it.
God, I am impressive occasionally.
I turned toward the rented car and started to walk with my head down against the wind. It was getting nippy up here. A few feet away from the car, I looked up and stopped dead in my tracks. I had company. James Truscott was sitting in the car's passenger seat.
Chapter 117.
This made no sense to me. Not at first, anyway.
What the hell was Truscott doing here? Obviously, he'd followed me again. But why? I was seeing red as I yanked open the car door on his side. My mouth was open to start to yell, but nothing came out. Not a word. Truscott wasn't here to cause me any trouble. At least not now. The rider was dead, propped up in the front seat like a statue.
"Just get in the car,"
said a voice from behind me.
"Don't cause a scene out here, because then I'll have to go in and shoot the nice old biddy who runs the country store, too. I really wouldn't mind, you know?"
I turned and saw Michael Bell. Bell looked haggard and disturbed, and he'd lost a lot of weight since I'd last seen him at his house. He looked like hell, actually. His light blue eyes were badly bloodshot. With his ragged, bushy beard, he looked like a local woodsman. "How long have you been following me?" I asked, trying to engage him if I could, feel him out, gain some kind of leverage.
"Just get in the car and drive, will you? Don't talk to me. I see through you."
We both got in, Bell in the back, and he pointed out to the road, the direction heading away from the interstate. I started the car and drove where he wanted me to, my mind racing backward and forward. My gun was in the trunk. How could I get to the trunk? Or how could I get inside his head in a hurry? "What's the plan, Michael?"
"The plan was for you to go back to Washington and for everyone to go on with their pitiful lives, but that didn't work out so well, did it? You should thank me for taking out the reporter, no?" He begged and sobbed for his life, by the way. Great performance. I believed him. What a wimp he turned out to be.
I was surprised he knew I was from D.C., and also about Truscott. But then he was a watcher, a plotter. There was probably a lot that Bell knew. "So what now?" I asked.
"What do you think? You're supposed to be the expert, right? So what happens now?"
"It doesn't have to go like this." I was just talking, saying anything that came into my mind.
"You gotta be kidding. What other way do you think it can go? Let me hear all of the choices. I can't wait."
Meantime, he had burrowed the barrel of his pistol into my neck. I leaned away, but only so far. I thought it was best if I knew exactly where his gun was. I wondered if he was executing a plan now, or if he was improvising at this point. Mary Smith had been known to do both. And this was Mary Smith, wasn't it? I'd finally met the real killer. We drove for a few miles on an unlit secondary highway.
"This looks good here. Go that way. Make a left." "Do it."
I turned off the pavement onto a bumpy dirt road. It sloped upward, winding away into the woods. Eventually, the fir trees closed around the car like a tunnel. I was running out of time, and it didn't look as if there was any way for me to escape. Mary Smith had me, just the way she'd gotten all the others and killed them without fail. "Where are we going, Bell?"
"Somewhere they won't find you right away, or your pen pal either."
"You know they're already looking for you in L.A. I made a call."
"Yeah, well, good luck to them. I'm not exactly in L.A., am I?"
"What about your girls, Michael? What about them?" He pushed the gun barrel harder into my neck.
"Not my fucking girls. Marty was a cheap little whore before I married her. Before I made her into something. I was a good father to those ungrateful kids. All for Marty. She was a runaround when I met her, and she stayed a runaround. Okay, pull over. This is good."
This was definitely not good. The car headlights showed where the road dropped off to a wooded slope on the right. I had to be real careful not to go over the edge. Then all at once, I thought the opposite. If I could force myself to do it. But I knew I had to. So I mashed the accelerator down and spun the steering wheel as sharply to the right as I could. Bell screeched.
"What the fuck are you doing? Stop the car! Stop!"
Three things happened, all at about the same time. Michael Bell's gun went off. I felt a universe of pain explode in my right shoulder, and the car started to plummet,
almost straight downhill. Chapter 118. Suddenly, the pain seemed to be everywhere in my body, and it was nothing if not extreme. I was only semi-conscious of thick fir trees and underbrush giving way to the car as it rocked and rolled and caromed out of control, threatening to flip. We probably fell for only 4 or 5 seconds. Still, the eventual impact was enough to jam my chest with incredible force against the steering wheel. The seatbelt probably saved me from going through the windshield. I knew Bell hadn't been wearing his and could only hope that he was badly hurt. If I was lucky, maybe he was unconscious, or dead, in the back seat. I already had my hand on the door handle, and I rolled out of the car as best and as fast as I could manage. My whole body throbbed with a numbing ache that made it hard to move quickly. My right arm hung useless at my side. I saw James Truscott's body face down and spread eagle in the dirt. Apparently, he'd been thrown loose in the crash. Then Michael Bell moaned in the back seat. He was alive inside. Too bad. With a great mustering of resources, I managed to get up on one knee. Suddenly, my shoulder screamed with pain. I knew it had to be broken. I took a halting step forward, expecting flat ground, but there was an almost invisible bank of tangled brush. I went down, landing in half a foot of water. I'd been totally unaware of the stream until now. It was shallow here, but the water stretched out farther across than I could see in the dark. The icy water sent an electric current of shock right through me. I hadn't thought the pain could get worse, but I saw a wash of white before my sight partially returned. Again, I started to push myself up, only to be knocked back down. This time it was Bell. He pushed down on my neck and head, and he was strong as hell. Then I felt his foot pressing down on my back. Water rushed up into my nose and mouth.
Where the fuck do you think? Oh!
I didn't give him a chance to finish. I scissored my legs hard against his ankle, and it took most of the rest of my strength just to do that. It caught him off guard, though, and he fell backward off of me. I heard 2 splashes and hoped one was his gun. Half in, half out of the water, leaning hard on my good left hand, I raised myself up enough to launch at him. I managed a ground tackle and then a left hook before he could respond. He reached up and laid a heavy grip on my face, digging in with his fingers. Michael Bell was about my height, but a super heavyweight. Despite his weight loss in the past few weeks, he had at least 30 pounds on me. I got a hand on his throat, dug in, and pushed as hard as I could. He gagged some, but didn't let go. Leverage was the only thing I might be able to increase, but when I moved my foot, it hit a slick of algae. The sudden shift of weight sent me lurching with an agonizing twist of my body, and I landed back in the freezing cold water. God, it was cold. But I almost didn't care. Michael Bell stood up faster than I did this time. Not a good sign. He had a second wind. The dead weight of my aching right arm slowed me down. I saw him in vague silhouette, picking up what looked like a flat rock about the size of an encyclopedia. He raised the rock high in both hands as he came toward me again.
You stupid fuck! I'll kill you! That's my plan, all right? That's how the story ends! This is how it ends!
I scrambled back and away from Bell as best I could, but I knew it wasn't enough. My hand landed on something hard in the shallow water. Not rock. At least I didn't think so. Metal?
You die! How's that for a plan? How's that for an ending?
The metal object. I knew what it had to be. I yanked Bell's gun out of the water and fumbled with the trigger.
Bell, no!
I screamed. He kept on coming with the enormous rock held over his head. So I fired. I couldn't tell exactly what happened in the moonlit woods. I had no idea where he was hit, but he grunted noisily and stopped for a second. Then he charged forward again,
I fired a second time, and a third. Both upper chest shots. At least I thought so. The heavy rock he was holding fell back into the water. Suspended by some invisible force, at least for a moment, Bell staggered away two or three drunken steps. Then he fell over face first into the water, making a loud splash. Then nothing. Silence in the woods. Trembling badly, uncontrollably, I kept the gun trained on Bell with my good hand. It took incredible effort just to get over the slick rocks to where he lay. By the time I reached him, there was no movement. I took his arm, held it up. I checked, but he had no pulse. I checked it again. Nothing. Nothing but the silence of the woods and the awful cold. Michael Bell was dead, and so was Mary Smith. And very soon, in these freezing wet clothes, I would be too. Chapter 119. My slow climb up and out of the gully from the crash site was hellish. Nothing but excruciating pain, dizziness, and nausea that passed in milliseconds. The only blessing was that I barely remembered any of it. Somehow I managed to get out to the main road, where an alarmed college student in a Subaru picked me up. I never even got his name. I guess I passed out in the back seat of his car. By the next morning, Michael Bell's body had been recovered from the stream, and I was resting in a bed at Fletcher Allen Hospital in Burlington. Resting is probably the wrong word, though. Local police came and went from my room continually. I spent hours on the phone with my office in Washington, the L.A. Bureau office, and Gene Galletta trying to piece together everything that had happened from the start of the murder spree. Bell's plan had been a feat of convolution and madness, but his cover was ultimately simple. Diversion. And he'd succeeded until the very end. As Gene pointed out to me, Michael Bell wrote and produced stories for a living. Plot was his thing. I wouldn't be surprised if this one ended up as a screenplay, written by someone else. The writer would probably change everything, though, until the movie carried the fishy title, Based on a True Story. Who's going to play you? Gene kidded me over the phone. I don't know. I don't much care. Pee-wee Herman. As for Mary Constantine, I wasn't sure how to feel about her. The cop in me had one response, but the shrink had another. I was glad she'd be getting back into the kind of treatment and care she needed. If Dr. Shapiro was right, maybe Mary was ultimately headed towards some kind of recovery. That was how I wanted to think about it for right now. Around 4 o'clock, the door to my room creaked open, and none other than Nana Mama poked her head inside. There's a sight for bedsore eyes, I said, and started to grin. Hello, Nana. What brings you to Vermont? Maple syrup, she cracked. She came in timidly, especially for her, and winced when she saw the truss around my shoulder. Oh, Alex, Alex. Looks worse than it is. Well, maybe not, I said. Did you have any trouble getting a flight? No trouble at all. You go to the airport, you pay money. She reached out to put a cool hand on my cheek. It felt familiar and so comforting. What would I do without this ornery old woman? I couldn't help thinking, what will I do? They said you're going to be fine, Alex. I suppose that's a relative concept, though, isn't it? I'd been shot before. It's traumatic, there's no way around that. But not irreversible, at least not so far. I'll be fine, I told Nana. Body and soul. I told the children to wait outside. I want to say something to you and then put it behind us. Uh-oh. I'm in trouble again, aren't I? Back in the doghouse. She didn't return my smile. but she did take my hand in both of hers.
I thank God for you every single day of my life, Alex, and I thank him for letting me raise you and see you turn into the man you did. But I want you to think about why you came to me in the first place, and what was going on between your poor parents before they died. Simply put, Jenny and Damon and Ali deserve better than you had.
Nana stopped to make room for what was coming next.
Don't make them orphans, Alex.
Chapter 120. I started to speak my piece, but Nana Mama went on, gently raising her voice.
I'm the first of us to go. Don't you dare argue with me.
Finally, I just shrugged, which hurt my shoulder and neck. What can I say?
Nothing. You say nothing. You just listen to my wisdom, wisdom of the ages. You listen, and maybe one day you'll finally learn something.
We shared a long look into each other's eyes. A lump rose in my throat, although what I felt wasn't sadness. It was more like gratitude, and the most incredible love for this small, incredibly powerful woman, who was indeed wise beyond her years and certainly mine. Believe it or not, I always listen to you, I said.
Yes, and then you go and do whatever you were going to do in the first place.
Sounds from the hospital corridor came into the room as the door opened halfway. I looked over to see Damon's eager face, and my heart did a little hop.
Look who it is! I wiped my eyes. The man of the house has arrived.
They told us Jenny can't come in 'cause she's under 12, he said.
I sat up in bed.
Where is she?
I'm right here.
Jenny's indignant tone came through clearly from behind the door.
Well, then get in here before anyone sees you. Come on. Nobody's gonna arrest you, except me, if you stay outside for 1 minute longer.
The two of them came in and rushed over to the bed, stopping short at the sight of my collection of bandages. I reached out with my free arm and took them both in at the same time.
How long do you have to be here?
Jenny asked into my good side.
Should be going home in a couple of days, I told her.
Looks worse than it is, said Nana.
Damon stood up again and looked at the truss.
Did it hurt really bad?
Badly,
Nana muttered. I've had worse, I said. They both looked at me with the same neutral, almost reproachful expression. Who was the parent here anyway? Somehow they seemed older than the last time I'd seen them. I felt a little older myself. 41 and a lot. These two were going to grow and change whether or not I was around to watch. Such an obvious thing, but the truth of it, the reality of it, suddenly inhabited me. I finally gave in.
Yeah, I said.
It did. It hurt a lot. And then, that terrible thought again.
Don't make them orphans, Alex.
And I held my kids so tight, even as my shoulder ached. But I couldn't let them go, and I couldn't let them know what I was thinking, either. Chapter 121. I stayed at the Fletcher Allen Hospital in Vermont for nearly a week, which was my longest hospital stay to date, and maybe another warning to me. How many warnings did I get? Around 6 o'clock in the evening on Friday, I received a call from Detective Gene Galletta out in L.A.
Alex, has anyone told you the news yet? She asked.
I assume they have.
What news, Gene?
That I'm being released from the hospital tomorrow?
I don't know anything about that, but yesterday Mary Wagner confessed to the murders here in L.A.
She didn't commit those murders. Michael Bell did.
I know that. Even Maddox Fielding knows it. Nobody believed her, but she confessed.
Then, sometime last night, poor Mary Wagner hung herself in her cell. She's dead, Alex. I sighed and shook my head a couple of times. I'm really sorry to hear that. It's just another death Belle is responsible for. Another murder. The following morning, I managed to get on a flight to Boston. From Boston, I caught the hourly shuttle to D.C. Never been so happy to get on a crowded commuter plane in my life. It was easiest to get a cab at the airport, and as I rode into Southeast around 7 o'clock that night, I felt a soft, warm glow spreading inside my body. The cab pulled up in front of the house on Fifth, and suddenly I was running across the small front lawn, then taking two long strides up the paint-faded front steps. I grabbed little Alex up in my arms, and I spun him up high in the air. It hurt, but it was worth it. I called back at the cabbie, who was leaning out his side window, a little befuddled, but even he was smiling some, in his slightly jaded DC cabbie way. "I'll be right there," I told him. "Be right with you." "No problem. Take your time, buddy. The meter's running anyway." I looked at Nana Mama, who had come out on the porch with my young son. "What?" I whispered. "Tell me what happened." "Ali is home," she said in a quiet voice. "Christine brought him here, Alex. She changed her mind again. She's not staying in the East either. Ali is home for good. Can you believe it?" "Now, how about you? Are you home?" "I'm home, Nana," I said. Then I looked into the beautiful eyes of my small son. "I'm home, Ali. I promise you. And I always keep my promises."
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of Mary Mary, written by James Patterson, and read by Peter J. Fernandez, Michael Lewis Wells, and Melissa Leo. Executive producer Maya Thomas, produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Production supervised by Dennis Kao. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.